When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Detachment is letting another person experience their consequences instead of taking responsibility for them yourself. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship. And if you're wondering what the hell an adult child is somebody whose unresolved childhood pain surfaces and plays out in adulthood, and not in a good way, folks. People-pleasing, codependency, approval-seeking, fear of people, fear of authority figures, fear of abandonment, addiction to excitement, an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, an inability to say no, feeling guilty standing up for yourself. And that's just to name a few, okay, of the nice side effects that we're dealing with here. And this is the podcast where we talk about what the hell to do about it. So today, folks, we are going all the way back to Adult Child episode 9, where I spoke with the mother-daughter duo behind the memoir, The Lost Years, Surviving a Mother and Daughter's Worst Nightmare. And let me tell you, this book truly has something for everyone, okay? We have addiction, enmeshment, codependency, boundaries, trauma, and most importantly, the life-saving magic of detachment. And so this is a story of a daughter, Christina, spiraling into years of addiction, and a mother, Connie, who had to learn the hardest lesson of them all, that loving someone doesn't mean saving them. So this book is raw, it's painful, it is deeply honest, and it is a very powerful reminder that sometimes the most loving thing that we can do is to let go. This book is also a really big reality check that the best way that we can support the people that we love, whether they are battling addiction or just trapped in their own unresolved, unhealed trauma, is by focusing on our own healing. And that means setting boundaries. That means practicing self-care. That means breaking dysfunctional family rules and doing the things that might feel counterintuitive to helping them or might make us feel guilty, might make us receive backlash from them. But that truly is our best bet. But listen, none of that comes with a guarantee that that it'll change them in any sort of way, but it is truly our best bet. And most importantly, it's how we save and heal ourselves. So let's get on with the damn show. But first, a few announcements. First off, I released today my final video in my YouTube series, The Many Faces of Functional Freeze. And we wrapped it all up today with the detached and disconnected floater. So this is for you folks out there who are just numb, totally disconnected from life, feel like they are just watching life happen to them. So see the link in the show notes to check that video out. Next, get your damn spot in Breathe to Heal. This is a 6-week breathwork and somatic healing course being facilitated by fellow member of the shit show, Teresa, who is a certified somatic and breathwork practitioner. There are only 9 spots left. You hear me? 9 spots left. I want to keep this somewhat intimate. I don't want this to just feel like it's a cafeteria. Or you know what I mean? That's probably not the best word. But there's 9 spots left. We're starting on May 14th. There are 2 different tiers available, one of which is you only get access just to the live sessions. Another tier, you get access to live sessions, the replays, as well as a 2-month membership to the shit show. So you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe-to-heal to get your damn spot. Don't sleep on this. And I'm telling you, breathwork has changed my life. It has helped me so much, especially if you were in functional freeze. As I've said before, this is a steal compared to what the cost of most somatic courses are. So get your damn spot. Next, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows that are doing the damn work to heal. We've had some bangers of meetings lately. I mean, they're always good, but man, the past few groups have just been so amazing. And the level of vulnerability and acceptance and just compassion that we show for one another is next level. Plus, we have fun, okay? If you have ever gone to a support group and left feeling like, I don't know if I felt much hope there, you know? I'm feeling kind of depressed, more depressed than I was when I got there. This ain't that place, okay? This is a place where we are tackling hard shit, but we are also lighten things up at times. So adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow for less than $1 a day. Damn the join. You, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever. How about today's the day? Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at adultchildpod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce Connie and Christina, the co-authors of The Lost Years, which, God, what has it been now? 13 years since you've written it?
It's been a while. Yeah. It's more like 16, I think. Is
wow.
It, Christina?
When did it come out? 2008?
I think we need to write an update on the book.
You could do like a 15-year checkup update?
You know, the book has done really well, you know, and we've had such great support. People actually ask a lot, right? And to your point on the topic of your podcast, frankly, right? So The Lost Years ends, you know, when I'm sober and happy and well, and same with my mom, right? But then there's, you know, all these years subsequently, and people check in about it and what we're doing now and what has happened after. And I don't know, there's just so much to be said for after sobriety, right? After the initial recovery. And so I think a book, you know, I've always thought, you know, for mom and I to write, you know, what's it called? A prologue or an afterthought?
Or sequel? No.
Yeah, just, you know, just a bit about what it's been like. I've been sober now 27 years. And my mom's been, you know, in her own recovery for, I don't know, 37 years. I mean, who knows, right?
Like, I hope not. Makes me like old. but yeah.
If I'm 27 years sober, you found your recovery at least 5 years.
At least, yeah, 30 years or, you know, 30, yeah, for sure.
Anyway, so that's my point, right? To you, you know, coinciding with your podcast about what happens after. And I think, you know what, to be frank with you, though, I was told many times that there is no interest in long-term sobriety. That's not where the drama is. It's not where the interest is. I had to take out 4 chapters of The Lost Years, 4 chapters, some of my favorite chapters. And they were the chapters of sobriety, right? The first time I got an apartment, my driver's, I mean, just all these monumental things in my life. But I was told, you know, multiple times, no one cares. It's not dramatic reading when you're better. And then even with Addicted and doing the television shows, I wanted to do a show about what happens after, right? After intervention, after treatment, and watching people get better and that beautiful journey, that bittersweet, cathartic journey of recovery. And I was told it doesn't make good television.
Well, that's what my podcast is really about, right? Like, that's the reason that I decided to create this, was because at 9 years sober, I found myself in even more pain than when I felt when I had gotten sober. And I think that so much has changed in the years since you guys have written that book. I just think about all of the medical advancements that have been made. There's so much more of an understanding of the impact to the brain of childhood trauma. And so I think it is a conversation that really, really, really needs to be discussed a lot more. And I think also too, think about, there's a lot of people I think that might get physical sobriety at first, but they are unable to maintain sobriety because they're not facing those deeper, darker root issues. So I think it is, I don't know. I think that there probably would be more of an audience. I mean, I sure as hell would love to read a prologue or hear all that stuff. I think that your book is so beautiful because it is not the story of addiction or alcoholism, but it is the story of the family disease of alcoholism or addiction, or the family disease of dysfunction. And I was hoping, Connie, that you could kind of talk about your kind of revelation of when you started to realize that the problem was not that you had a daughter who was an addict, but that this was part of a larger family system of dysfunction. And that in fact, yes, she was the identified patient, but in reality, she was sounding the alarm bell for a much larger issue at hand. And I think that was a really pivotal point in the book when you start to realize that it's not just her that's the problem and it's the family at large. So I was hoping you could talk about that.
Sure. Well, I remember the first time that I actually acknowledged out loud that my husband was an alcoholic. And I called my therapist and I cried and cried on the phone, because to me, I had watched my father-in-law drinking early in the morning when we would go to visit them. I realized, oh, I think he's putting something in his orange juice, you know? So I saw that. And then all of a sudden I'm watching my husband and I just realized, my goodness, and it was terrifying to me. The reason it was terrifying, first of all, this is 16 or 20 years ago when we didn't have all the knowledge about the disease system. And, you know, it was still more about a personality defect or a person, you know, there's something wrong with a person, rather than understanding there's a disease here that impacts that person. And yes, they have to take responsibility for their actions, but maybe they didn't, they certainly didn't mean to be an alcoholic, you know? So I saw the family dynamics go from one generation to the other. And so I was terrified because I thought, this is not something I can fix. I mean, if he had cancer, I could go to the doctor with him and we could get a pill or a, you know, chemotherapy or something to fix this. But what terrified me the most was I couldn't fix it. There was no fix for it, mm-hmm. except his fix. You know, he was going to have to fix what was wrong with him, but I had to fix what was going on with me and with my children. And so that was a terrifying day, but I think it was, I would say, my bottom. And I started going to a 12-step program. Can we say what?
Yeah, of course.
Program. Okay, so I started going to Al-Anon, and I went like 3 and 4 times a week eventually. I found different meetings, and then I found some parent meetings. And somehow I was sitting in one of these parent meetings. It was a Wednesday night, small group in a little cottage in Larkspur. And I was sitting in the group, I went, oh my God, this is not about Christina. This is about my marriage. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. And so from there, you know, we took off with that. And eventually I had to leave him. And I didn't want to leave him, because I was the only, nobody in my family had ever been divorced. That was not in my thinking when I was growing up or getting married or any choices. That direction wasn't in my thinking. But I finally had to say, look, if you don't quit drinking, I'm going to leave you. And I'm going to take the kids and we're going to leave. So he did quit drinking, but he didn't get sober. You know what I'm saying? The difference. He was like held it really tight. You know, I would see him come home from work and he'd lay down on the bed and he'd hold his hands really tight in a fist. And it was terrifying there because we had obligations and he was our breadwinner, you know. So all this was taking place. And finally, I had to find the courage to leave. Mm-hmm. So and from there, you know, I could divorce myself from him emotionally and physically and really focus on myself. You know, but it's a process. It's such a process. It's not an overnight. I mean, you might even realize that you can make choices that are different, but to implement those is a different story, you know? For me, it was anyway. It took me a lot of time and courage and support from others in the program to, you know, to really start my growth program. So I don't know if that answers any of your questions, but
sure as hell does.
That's, yeah. You know, that's what was kind of how it started for me.
Yeah, I think that that's so true, where first comes awareness, right? And then we kind of have to sit in the awareness and then that becomes uncomfortable. And then we're finally able to, you know, take a change and take action. Christina, could you at the time, I mean, obviously you were full blown in your addiction, but could you see that your mom was changing? Well, like, was that apparent to you at the time or just in hindsight?
Well, first I want to say, Mom, I feel emotional. Like every time I hear you talk, I just feel emotional. And I feel like every time I learn something new, or maybe I just hear it different about your story and how it was for you. You know, maybe I think that's really the gift of family recovery. It's just this continued growth and understanding, compassion and empathy. And as I get older, as I'm sober longer, as I've raised my own children, right? Every major monumental phase in my life, I have a new respect and understanding for my mom, you know? So that makes me emotional. Like I just learned that my grandfather drank in the morning. I had no idea. Like that's a new piece of information, Mom, that I did not know about my grandfather. So thanks for that. So anyway, your question, did I see my mom change? So I did see my mom change. So before I left the house permanently, which was young, of course, because I was addicted and I left home when I was 18 after, as you know, right? After many, 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 many stops. But what I started to see, I remember when my mom found Al-Anon. In fact, I say all the time that Al-Anon ruined my fucking life, right? Like my mom found Al-Anon and my life was over as I knew. Right. She got this sponsor and she got a spine and things started to change in my world. Like this is what I saw. Right. She just started setting boundaries and holding boundaries. She started to say no. She started and certainly with me, but I just ran over everything she said anyway. So it's not that my behavior necessarily changed, if that makes sense, but hers did. But I saw it with my dad. Like she started to stand up to him. Like I remember one time, never forget. So my parents were like super into having dinner every single night, the six of us. And my mom would make dinner seven nights a week, which I find so bizarre. I mean, I fed my kids seven nights a week, but, you know, maybe a burrito here and mm-hmm. there, you know, macaroni and cheese made at home, but nonetheless. So I remember one time, I'll never forget it, when she started to change and we were eating dinner. And this was like a big event in my house. You have to understand, like, come hell or high water, you were home for dinner, right? It wasn't like an option. And my dad sat at the head of the table and he kind of owned that table. And we were all really scared of my dad. But this one night during dinner, and I don't even know what happened between my mom and him, or maybe it was me and you, Mom, but my mom stood up in the middle of dinner and walked out the door. And I just remember all of us were like, what? And like my dad didn't know what to do, and none of us kids knew what to do. And when I say she walked out the door, I mean, she literally stood up and walked out the door. And that's, my mom started walking at that time. Like, I know that sounds strange, but literally walking. And she will tell you that walking saved her life, right? And she would walk in one direction, tell God all her problems, walk back and tell God all the things she was grateful for. So she literally stood up from the dinner table, walked out of the house, and just took a walk or wherever she went. But what I was left with was this, it was so profound for me to see her change. And then to listen to her and set boundaries and hold boundaries. And of course, the most monumental boundary in my life was at the age of 18 when my mom closed the door on me and said, "You're not welcome in my home or in my life until you're living a life of recovery. And if I never see you alive again, I want you to know how much I love you." Right. And she closed the door on me. So that was, of course, profound. But I'll tell you, the greatest gift of her recovery is this. When it took me to the age of 21 to find my way to treatment, so 18 to 21, right? And I was homeless and I did all the things which you can read in the lost years. But when I hit bottom in that homeless shelter and I was really standing on the edge of my end, I called my mom for help. I didn't call my dad or, you know, anyone else. I called my mom for help because I trusted her not to save me. I knew that I couldn't be saved and that on some level I had to fight my way out of this for it to mean anything to me. Again, I couldn't articulate it at the time, but I trusted her not to save me. Mm-hmm. I needed to hurt. I needed to hurt in order to change. And I didn't want to be saved. I just needed the way out to be illuminated. And that's what my mom gave me that night that I called. And she said, "Are you calling for help?" I said, "I am." And she said, "This is where you can go. Here's the number of the place, right? Good luck. Hope you find your way." And hung up the phone, right? So that was one of the greatest gifts of her program, that Al-Anon taught her how to love me enough to stay out of the way.
We had tried everything we knew, everything you can list for a parent to try to manage your child. We had done it and it never worked. It might work for a week or 2 weeks, but it wouldn't work constantly. And I just kept thinking, you know, I had to let her figure it out herself. I finally realized, oh my God, when she ran from that last treatment center, I said, "Oh, I'm not in charge here." There, I mean, I finally accepted totally from a guttural inside, you know, hit the bottom feeling. I accepted that I had no power over my child. So of course, when she came to the door, I mean, I just said, "Well, you're going to have to make your way, because I, you know, if I could fix it, I would fix it, but it wasn't going to be fixed." And I realized that. And when I said that, "You've got to go and make your way. You can't come home," because she'd come home for 2 weeks and then it'd be back to the old deal again. So I said that, and I closed the door and I turn around and here's my husband sitting at the table with his mouth hanging open. He could not believe that I had done that. He just could not, nor could I actually. But it was just at that point, it was the natural thing for me to do. It was a natural progression of things, you know, because you just try it and you try it and you try it again. And then you learn over time that it doesn't work and something else has got to happen. And so that's how it came to be. And so I'm grateful. I thought she'd come home after a couple weeks or something, but she didn't. And so, you know, she would call from wherever she'd be wanting to come home. And I'd say, "Well, are you ready for treatment?" And she would be really angry. She might even hang up on me. And I just always ask her the same question: "Are you ready for treatment?" And she never said yes. So I got, okay, that's fine. We have to make a life without her. you know, we can continue. I went to my meetings, you know, I had my sponsor. We walked once a week. I did a lot of walking, like Christina says. I'd leave the house and I'd talk, constantly about my problems. And then I'd turn around and come back. By the time I got home, I had fixed them all. Say, okay, well, that happened, but this is the good part, you know. So I'd put myself back together and get home. And that's how we survived that period of time. And so I'm forever grateful that she found sobriety. And she found it on her own, you know, and accepted it. And it's deep within her. And I really so appreciate and respect Christina's sobriety. It's amazing to me. It's very powerful to see.
But for those three, so you left your husband during those 3 years, right? Wasn't it that during 18 to 21? Yeah.
Yes. I left eventually. And some interesting things. So I told him one day that I was thinking about leaving. I needed a break from the marriage. And then I told him the next day, you know, I'm really thinking about this. So it took me about 3 days to say, I'm going to leave the marriage. So he says, well, okay, then you just get the kids together and you tell them all together, you. So he's going to punish me in some way that I'm going to have to say that. So we called this family meeting. And actually, we got Christina to come to this meeting. And so we're all sitting there. And I'm sitting on the floor, which is so indicative of how it used to be, that he's up here in the chair and I'm on the floor, you know. But I said, okay, when they were all there, I said, okay, I need a break from this marriage. And so we're going to have this break. So my middle daughter gets up out of the chair and she comes and she sits on one side. I mean, she says, I need a break too. And then the youngest one comes and sits on the other side of me and says, I need a break too. So here's the three of us. And then Christina is crying. Oh my God, she's crying. I've never seen anything so agonizing in my life. And she said, oh, it was too late for her. You know, that's really been a sad thing in my recovery. As I'm getting older, I'm remembering things. Like, I don't hope I'm not getting Alzheimer's, but I'm remembering things and that are very deeply buried, you know, and that's one of the things I remember. And so I understand a lot more why she was running from all these treatment centers, because it really wasn't fair for me to put her in this position to be the one to say what's going on in our family. That wasn't fair. It was my job, you know, but I couldn't see it that way. It was too confusing. And I had this vision of us, this family that was going to be like what I had when growing up myself, which was a lovely little family, you know, and that's what I was wanting for us. But alcoholism makes it very difficult to have that loving family that you want to have, because that disease is very destructive for the person suffering and for the family and the people that love them and watch them and are terrified of things that happen and, you know, react in ways that might not be helpful. So I remember when I left, when I called the moving company, several days, canceled, called them again. I mean, it was a real process. And so then they came and I called my neighbors to come and help me. I told the kids to go get the Christmas decorations. And I went through the house and I said, take what you like and leave the rest. So that little slogan from Al-Anon just kept ringing in my head. I just like, take what you like and leave the rest. So I didn't need all this baggage, you know. I took what was important for us to manage as a family without living all together. But I've always been grateful for that. And I always thought, well, I can replace these things. It's just things. I can, you know, what's important, I can replace. But I love that. Al-Anon really helped me to move on.
Now, Christina, were there any significant like faulty beliefs or faulty programming from that was ingrained during your childhood that surfaced in your sobriety? Anything significant that you can think of?
Yeah. I mean, could you give me an example of that?
Belief that we're unlovable or that we're inherently flawed or just something that as you were sober, something that was continuing to cause you pain in sobriety and you realized that it was unfinished business from childhood.
Yeah, well, sure.
All right, shit show ladies. Have you ever had those days where everything just feels so much damn harder than normal and you can't figure out why? I already know the answer to that question is yes. And boy, have I definitely had more than my fair share of those days and totally get just how frustrating this can be. But recently, I've learned that sometimes it's not just stress, lack of sleep, a dysregulated nervous system. It could also be my hormones at play. And that is where Happy Mammoth comes in. They offer a free 2-minute quiz that can help you uncover the root cause of your hormonal symptoms. It's super easy. Any shit show can do it. Just answer a few questions about what you've been going through and where you're at in life. After taking this quiz, you'll get personalized recommendations to help balance your hormones and start feeling better. So I took this hormone quiz myself. The quiz suggested that my body may be overloaded with estrogen, which is affecting me in all kinds of ways. And one of the recommendations that I got was to start taking Hormone Harmony, which helps with bloating, chronic fatigue, weight gain, mood swings, and more. And after adding it to my routine, I've definitely noticed a difference. Now, taking care of your hormones isn't just about feeling good right now. It's also about investing in our healing journey. And so by taking this quiz, you'll learn more about your hormone balance, which will allow you to start making small, intentional changes to support you on this healing journey. Whether it's the Hormone Harmony or another Happy Mammoth product, the quiz helps guide you towards solutions that work specifically for you. So if you're ready to start feeling like yourself again, head over to happymammoth.com and take their free 2-minute hormone quiz today to find out the ultimate answer to your stubborn hormonal issues. And for a limited time, you can also get 15% off your entire first order with my code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
You know, I think I struggled so much in my early sobriety with feeling, you know, I knew that I was loved and wanted all the days of my life. You know, I definitely knew I was loved and wanted, but I felt very broken from the time I can remembering, you know, who I was. I felt very broken and disjointed, kind of shattered to pieces on the inside, you know, held only together by my skin, right? And that's what I loved about substances, is it seemed to kind of glue all those pieces together. And so, you know, in my early recovery, I would say that all of my recovery has been about learning to love myself, be at peace with myself, find my voice and my strength. And I don't know, just really love who I am. And I, you know, I am definitely in that place, right? I love who I am. I love my life. I love my struggles and my fight, but you know, all of it. I think my early sobriety was filled with that. It was quite the journey. And I told you at 5 years sober. So I got sober. And then I feel like I did more in 5 years than, I don't know, most people do in a decade for sure. And I did more in a decade than most people do in 20, right? Like starting a business and wrote a book and, you know, educated myself and, you know, got married, had children, right? I did so, so much. And I hit a huge emotional bottom, the first one in my sobriety. And the bottom was, you know, that I stood at this place in my life that I never thought I'd be. And I worked so hard, like all those things I did, it was like this massive game of catch up, right? Like I wanted to catch up and make up for all the things that I didn't do. I wanted to do all the things that I didn't do. I wanted to make my mom proud. I wanted to get somewhere. I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to do all these things that I didn't do when I was busy being addicted. And I realized when I got to the place that I did all these things, but I felt worse at that point than I had in all my sobriety. It was weird and really, really painful. And I felt very lost. And it's very painful to be, say, 5 years sober, right? At the, you know, in the middle of this amazing career that I had created, you know, marriage. I mean, all these things I thought were the things I was supposed to have or get back or get. And I felt worse and more lost than ever. It's very painful to be sober and feel so broken, right? It's like when you're a newcomer, you know, in your first year of sobriety, feeling broken is standard, right? And people stand and cheer and clap because you get up every day and brush your teeth. Right. And then it's like, here I am, five years sober, and no one's clapping because I brush my teeth anymore. Right. And somehow I'm supposed to have the answers. I have my life together in a way that I didn't think possible, nor did anyone else think possible. And I ended up feeling worse than ever. And what I realized was I was empty. It was hollow on the inside. And what I had on the outside just didn't matter. And I do believe, to be frank with you, that my emotional recovery began at 5 years sober, which is interesting, by the way, because a great mentor of mine, Stephanie Brown, Dr. Stephanie Brown, she talks about early recovery being the first 5 years. And I remember when I first heard that, and I actually was quite offended, like, fuck you. I'm not early recovery, right? Like, I got 3 years sober, like I'm killing it. Like, I know my shit, lady. And then I hit 5 years sobriety and I felt like, as if she mapped it out, right? And I just fell apart. So I don't know, maybe that was a really long answer to your question, but I do believe my emotional sobriety began there. And I believe that was the journey of healing the inner child, right? Really reckoning with who I was on the inside and coming to terms with, you know, those harder, deeper, more significant childhood issues and all those things. So, and the other spiritual bottom I have is at 18 years sober. Again, very, very painful to be 18 years sober, supposed to have all these answers, right? Have a television show or two or five, and literally be at the top of your career, making more money than ever, right? Kids, the whole thing, and feeling more lost than I ever have in my life, really ever before in all my life. And I don't know if people talk about those things enough.
So what would be, I mean, you kind of just talked about some stuff that I think you probably would include in the sequel, but what would be something as far as, I guess, you know, the family recovery aspect, like what would be something significant that you guys would want to touch upon, or is there, have there been any significant realizations since you've written the book?
Mom, do you want to go?
Well, I'd like to say how, I don't know how this has happened, but we have a very close family now. I think, you know, and I mean, everybody's busy doing their lives, but we support each other, like sporting events for the grandkids, for my grandkids, you know, families back and forth, carpooling, and we have family dinners. We, before the pandemic, we had family dinners maybe 5 or 6 times a year to celebrate birthdays. And I think everybody looked forward to coming to the family dinners, and I would enjoy standing back in the kitchen and watching my children just come and yak it up with each other, and the kids were happy. And I don't know how it happened. I think my parents, my children's grandparents on my side, they were very into family as well. And so that's how I, you know, experienced family. And I was wanting that for my own family. And I think we have it. How much of that is sobriety driven, I don't know. But really, we do have alcohol in our home sometimes, you know, but it's not the focus of our family dinners. And sometimes nobody has anything to drink. Sometimes I'm the only one that has a glass of wine, and everybody else, nobody else does. I mean, it's lovely. It's lovely to have that and not feel, you know, I know families get together and they drink a lot, and we just don't. So I'm really, really grateful for all that we've accomplished as a family unit, just the mere fact that we support each other and enjoy each other's company, the grandchildren as well. So as after addiction, I'm just grateful for how it's turned out, because it could have gone another way as well. I don't know what Christina has to say about that, but I'm really grateful that we can all be enjoying each other at this point.
You know, I think in the sequel, I guess I would talk about, obviously, the continued health and connection. But I think if I were to try and summarize the course of my life in the last 2.5 decades, is how our lives, how our family, our relationships, right? Like, it's going to make me emotional, but like how I've raised my children, how I live my life, how I run my business, how I interact with, you know, my clients, my friends, you know, is all a byproduct of family recovery, right? And every major event that we've had as a family since the last years, right? So burying my father, which, as you might imagine, for so many reasons, was such an extraordinary process of him, you know, making peace with him and then helping him die, essentially. I helped my father die and held his hand while he took his last breath, right? Raising my children, giving birth to 2 children. And the like I said, the deeper understanding I have for my mom, God, and like the profound respect I have for her. You know, now that I have raised 2 children, well, they're 18 and 21, like the profound respect I have for her that she stood at that door and closed the door on me, right? Like, I guess what I'm saying is I think that everything we are, the whole way we operate from all those challenging issues, right? And then finding my husband dead, right? I mean, he died by suicide. So what that did to me, what that did to my children, what that did to my family, how we all came together, how we fought our way out of that is all defined and structured by the principles of family recovery, right? I mean, Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, if we were just to forego anonymity, has truly shaped my whole life. I look at my children and they are a reflection of the principles that my mom set into motion 30 years ago. Mm. Right? And then, like, with the lost years, my mom and I traveled all over the country. Like, we've been everywhere. Like, places you don't even know are like a place. Right? With this little book that we wrote, right? Like, 2 no-name people in some random little place wrote this book and somehow launched into this amazing career. But my point is, for a decade, I learned more about my mom in the most incredible ways, unexpected ways on that journey than I ever would have expected. probably one of the greatest gifts of the book actually has nothing to do with the book and everything to do with the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the trips we've made, I mean, when you take a trip with your child, you know, you get to have them to yourself more or less. I mean, you don't share with their family, you're together. And we had some nice conversations and experiences.
That was fun.
Yeah, we've had a really good time together. And I told her I said, Christina, when you're 70, I want you to think about your mother. I'm running through the airport, pulling my suitcase, trying to keep up with my daughter. I mean, it's quite something. I said, well, maybe it's good for my my well-being that I have to keep up with her, because, you know, we'd have these short stops in between. We had to switch planes or whatever, change. It was quite something. I mean, really, I feel real privileged to have that experience, and also to see firsthand how people respond to her story, which is quite powerful, you know. And we speak to groups that are not in recovery. And a lot of these groups are people who have children, and they're anxious not to have the same issue that we have, you know, had. So they want to know, what magic potion do we have that's going to help us not have problems with our children drinking and using alcohol and drugs and so on? And of course, we really don't have. We can only share our experience. We don't have a trick up our sleeves or anything. We just have to share our experience and hope that they take something from that. But it's been a joyful journey, really, really and truly, going from all the terrible things we experienced to now having this joy and this shared experience. It's really grand. I love it.
What sort of impact did the book have on your siblings, Christina?
Good question. They were really supportive of the book from the start. You know, we sat down in the beginning because I felt really strongly that, you know, it's their story too, right? It's their story that we're about to put on a national stage. So we did all sit around and talk about it. I think it was insightful and educational for all of them. It brought us all together. It started some provocative conversations for sure, but in all, they were really supportive. And I think they continued to be supportive over the years and really kind of sat back in real amazement and celebration of mom and me and watching us travel and do this together and speaking engagements and book signings. And I don't know, it turned out to be a real family. Just kind of changed, you know, affected and encouraged, uplifted, I don't know, challenged, you know, all of us. It's been great. And I don't know, you know, it's great, right? To see my brother, I mean, like at our hometown book signings, right? They're all there in the front row, just without hesitation, you know, without hesitation or question. Undeniably supportive, even though it was vulnerable for them, right? Like, it's not easy to have your darkest days, your family secrets, right, out there for the whole world to see or to read and have no control over what they think of it or what they do with your words, you know? It's a very vulnerable feeling for them too, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right off the bat, was your plan always to write this book where it was both you and your mom, or did you initially set out to write it yourself? And then how did that process work to where you guys came together?
Yeah. So I think, you know, from the time I got sober, I mean, I knew I've always liked to write, right? But I knew I wanted to write a book. It was kind of always in my head, and people would tell mom and I all the time, you know, you guys should write a book. But eventually it was like the whisper whispered to a scream, right? Like it was always in my mind. And then it just got louder and louder until one day I sat down to just write the book. And I do believe I wrote the original manuscript in about 90 days.
Wow.
But what kept coming to me when I sat down to write the book, right? And the first few pages of the book have been left untouched, like no editing. So that's just how it started. And so as I was writing the story or the experience of hitting bottom, which is how the book starts, it just kept coming to my mind. I got to get my mom, like, this isn't the whole story. This isn't the whole story. So it wasn't necessarily a decision to write a book with my mom. It was more of a calling, mm-hmm. like a direction that I was pulled into, because I started to write an addiction memoir and I was sitting there writing this memoir thinking, this means nothing without my mom. Like my mom is the hero of this story, frankly, right? And I kept thinking like every major point in my addiction, my mom was there. So how do I write this story and not have my mom's story involved? So that's kind of how it came about. And that original manuscript, I would call my mom and interview her basically, like, whatever. And I got it totally wrong and whatever. So when the manuscript got picked up by a literary agent, she basically said, your mom's got to tell her story. So although I wrote the original manuscript in about 90 days, the actual writing of The Lost Years and what you read today took about a year with my mom.
And what was that process like for you, Connie?
Well, it was interesting. I thought, yes, let's write a book. And so she went off and did it. and that was terrifying. It is. It's very terrifying. I didn't know what was going to. I said, well, how am I going to show up in this book? I better get involved, because who knows what she's going to say. And the truth of the matter is, yeah, she needed my input. but it was terrifying. And it was like doing a four step, you know, with your child. I mean, it was very interesting. And she would call me up at night and we'd she's fast on the computer. So she'd be typing and typing and I'd be saying things. And I'd say, well, don't write that. Don't put that in the book. She'd, oh yeah, that's good. We're going to leave that. Come on, Christina, take that. No, no, that's good. We're going to leave. anyway, it was quite something, you know. We had editors, we had two editors and along the way we edited as well. And so I said at the end, you know, Christina, let's do this. You read your part and I'm going to read my part and let's see if they stand alone. And I believe they do. And at the end of that exercise, I said, you know, this is a pretty good book. I think somebody's going to want to read it. And sure enough, we got a publisher and somebody wanted to read it. A lot of people wanted to read it. And they pass it on. You know, it's a pass along book. So buy it if you want, but
mostly buy it.
Mostly buy it.
You know, I think probably twice, you know, there's probably twice as many people that read it that bought it. Because like my mom said, it's a pass along book. You know what I mean? It's one of those books you read and you're like, oh my God, my sister has to read this. You know, whatever. So it's kind of a grassroots type of book, but whatever. So buying's preferred, but reading is encouraged.
It's such a beautiful story of just how the ripple effect of when one family member seeks treatment, and especially you didn't have the support of your husband. And I just think about how many people would have, you know, just given up. And it's just the beautiful story of how the impact that can happen when one family member seeks treatment. And obviously that's not the norm, right? I wish it always had that ripple effect. Unfortunately, it does not. But when one family member seeks treatment, the rest of the family sure as hell has a much better chance than if they don't.
Right. Yeah, I can remember the first time we went to a treatment family program, and they talked about the mobile. And the mobile to me is such a visual example of what happens in a family. I mean, you've got your mobile and you just move one piece. You take one piece away, you know, you change one piece and the whole thing shifts. Now, you might not like the way it shifts, you know, but it does shift. There's no way that you can have one member change dramatically their feelings or their reactions or their boundaries and not have others react. It's very powerful, I think, as a family system. Just find one person. And unfortunately for yourself, maybe you're the one person. We don't know it. You know, you don't have control. That's the thing about this disease. We don't have control. There's no pill that you can pop in and feel better or ready for sobriety or something. So,
yep. And remembering too, that like, even if it doesn't affect the current living family members, it has a huge impact on future generations, which is
right.
So important too. So
I think that's true because I feel like, I know there are probably alcoholics on my side, but there's a very, very strong, long line of alcoholics on my husband's side, being his mother, his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather. So it's a very ingrained family system that I married into. And I think we changed that dynamic. I feel like we've changed that dynamic in our family. So my mm-hmm. children don't have to pass that on, and their children don't either. So hopefully, you know, there's no guarantees in life, but the more people you love, the more risk you take. So we have to be willing to take the risk, you know. So just mm-hmm. remember that. And I hope I haven't seen any, you know, I have 7 grandchildren. So I'm praying that they're all manage their use of alcohol or drugs if that were their choice, or maybe they'll be sober. I don't know.
Any closing comments from you, Christina?
Closing comments. I mean, outside of just, I don't know. I mean, maybe.
Maybe she has a comment. I've never seen her so at a loss for words, tell you the truth.
I mean, there's like so much that I've been sober almost 28 years. And I guess when I think about emotional sobriety, it's been such a cathartic journey. And I think, you know, when you're brave enough to live large enough and, you know, it's like chest forward and vulnerable and open to all of it, right? To all that life has to offer. It's just the emotional sobriety is, it just gets deeper and it's definitely a journey. And I don't know, right? Like you never get to a place in sobriety where life, like where difficult things don't happen. I've learned that, you know, that difficult things happen even many, many, many years after, right? So I don't know what I'm saying. It's just been a great, my emotional sobriety has been a journey and many ups and downs and all the life experiences along the way. Like I said, like raising kids and burying my husband and falling in love again, and, you know, growing older with my siblings and my mom. And I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying. I just...
Life is good as it should be. As you say, not without problems and issues that come about, but somehow the tools are there now to manage what comes our way. So.
Well, this has been amazing. Where can people find you if you want to be found, either one of you?
Yeah. So let's see. My Instagram is at Christina Wanzelak. My website is Full Circle Intervention. And you can always Google the lost years surviving a mother and daughter's worst nightmare. That'll certainly take you to Amazon.
I'll put it in the show notes so people can find it.
Great. And it's, you know, on Audible or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. you can listen to it or read it.
I think, isn't there that lost years? Do we have that website still?
Yeah, but it scares me because I don't really know if it works or not.
Well, I think recently we got something.
But I have it on my full circle intervention.
Yeah. So, and for me, you'd get me through Christina. She's the...
That's how I got you today, so.
I'm on mom's agent, so.
Yeah, I'm kind of, I'm retired. Doing other stuff.
Yeah, living your life.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you both so much. I know that you gave so much hope and inspiration to so many people. So I just feel so grateful, and just the love between you two and everything that you've been through. It's just really amazing to see, and makes me emotional as well. And this is my first time really talking to either one of you. So thank you so much. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us. Yes, that's great.
Bye, Mama.
Bye, Dom.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.